Chapter 3, My First 5 Years. It doesn't take me long to understand I should have waited a little before this drive to Vegas. Adam Egert worked all night, setting off in the smallest morning hours for a 5-hour drive with a clown at the wheel who refuses to take the magic pills that keep you awake. It's just plain stupid. But there's something about Las Vegas that makes you want to be there right now. The white Challenger is having trouble staying in its lane, and Adam Egert has a heavy-lidded look to him. In front of us, a semi-full of trembling logs weaves close, and as its tail takes a swipe at the Challenger, I yell, and Adam Egert gives his head a quick shake. I know I'd better tell him a story, give him something to focus on. You know, that's the job of a passenger in a car on a long road trip, after all. So I pull out a vial of liquid morphine and sink my cigarette in it. The narcotic dries fast, adhering to the tobacco. I light up and inhale deeply, listening to the wondrous crackling as the fire hits my lungs and the smoke hits my brain. Then the smoke clears, and then the place where it was is now a picture. The picture is of a tough old farm, 100 acres of godforsaken, hard and unyielding soil, with a broke-down house and a barn that's in even worse shape, red paint peeling down its side like dried blood. There are 30 head of dairy cattle, 50 chickens, 5 hungry hogs, and 1 obsolete mule. And there are 7 hicks there as well. There in the field I see my father, scythe in hand, sweating hard as the hay falls before him. He works from sun to moon, stopping only for moments to wipe his already soaked handkerchief across his ruddy brow. At the well, my mother is pumping water from 100 feet below the earth and filling buckets that should be too heavy for such a slight young woman. On the porch of my home, my grandmother is sitting in a hardwood chair with an axe in her hand and dancing in broken circles with a roaring fountain of blood where its head should be, is a Dominicker hen. Tonight's dinner. I turn my head toward the car window, but I see no desert. I see the North 40, where old Jack, the hired hand and the best man I've ever known, is driving a tractor twice as old as he is. The tractor has an orange triangle on its back, and it bounces over the uneven earth. It's plain to see that the small, hard seat is hurting old Jack. In the wagon behind the tractor is my younger brother, Leslie, squealing delight in a carnival of hay bales. Walking down the lane with long arms full of short logs is my older brother, Neil. Neil is the only one of us kids who has to do chores. He is 9 years old. My grandmother says he's between grass and hay. I see the cat, who's licking himself and swatting horseflies with his tail as he lies beneath an improbably large maple tree that is blighted and dying. I look up the tree and see there is something up high, too, hiding in one of the crooks of its reaching branches, something that is watching. And the back of my head hits the headrest as I see that the thing in the tree is me. I look to Adam Egert and see that he's beginning to drift away, and I understand that I've been silent this whole time. I take a long drag from my magic cigarette, close my eyes again, and a new and brighter picture displays itself before me. I begin to speak what it is that I see. When I was young, I was in great shape. I was in my peak physical condition back when I was 1. Man, I looked great. I even looked good for my age. Strangers would always approach me, smiling. And they'd say, "Look at you, little boy. What are you, 0? "Oh, no," my mother would giggle. "He's 1. "Well, I'll be danged. He doesn't look a day past 0. "Oh, no, he's 1, she'd blush proudly. My mother did all my talking for me back then because I hadn't got the hang of it yet. Back then, my best friend was a cat who only knew 1 word, meow. But at the time, it was 1 more word than I knew. I thought the cat had it all figured out. While my mother and father raced and chased through the world, the cat luxuriated on the hard wooden floor. His eyes were green, and shone like the moon. And when the cat rubbed up against my belly, I could feel his purr deep inside me, as if I was the one purring, and this made me feel just as happy as a cat. Those were sweet days, I'm here to tell you, mostly on account of the way everyone was so mightily impressed by anything I'd do, and I mean anything. I'd walk into the room holding a grape. "Look who has a grape! Aren't you the smartest boy in the whole wide world?" Sometimes all I had to do was show up. "Look who it is! Did you come out to see what was going on in here? Aren't you the smartest boy in the whole wide world?" Truth is, everyone had to be somewhere, and I was there, that's all, just as they all were. But I wasn't going to turn down any of these compliments. They thought I was pretty special, all right, and that was fine by me. It seemed like life was going to be nothing but swell, with me spending my time doing what I damn pleased, and everybody else spending their time being impressed. All that changed one day, when I was about 3 years old. I came busting into the parlor where my folks were sitting with my grandma, and in my hand was a grape. "Look here," I said, just as proud as sin, "I found another grape." "Then eat the damn thing," said my father. "You'll do no such thing," my mother told me, and then turned to my father. "There's no telling where he found it." I was frightened and confused because I sensed something had changed irrevocably. As I left the room, I heard my grandma say, "Is there something wrong with that boy?" I love my grandmother. Everything she did had to do with the making of food for the rest of us. I would lie on the coal linoleum of the kitchen floor and watch her work. My favorite was when she'd reduce vinegar. When vinegar is reduced, it becomes its own essence. All that is not necessary evaporates. And my grandmother said that all it takes for that reduction to take place is time. Just time. There's a picture of my grandmother on the kitchen wall, a picture of her as a young woman. And I would look between the picture and my grandmother and be unable to recognize each and the other. In the picture, she was plump and large. Outside the picture, she was thin and shrunken. There was no fat on her at all. I could see the way her flesh draped over her bones. Sometimes I would shudder. And, of course, there was old Jack, who to this day is the most unforgettable fellow I've ever met. My father once told me how he had come to be hired. Seems old Jack just showed up one day and asked if there was work to be had. "Plenty of work," my father replied, "but can't afford you." "Then I'll work for nothing," said old Jack. And so he did. Old Jack lived in a tool shed way back in the North 40, and for his work he got 3 squares a day, and that was it. But I think he got more than that, because old Jack never mentioned family or home. And so I think he got that in the deal, too. My favorite times were in the evening, when my father would have company over. That's what we called it back then, company. And the old men would show up at the house and take a chair and a beer, and they'd Cracker Barrel the night away. My father was old when I was born. He was 2 generations before me. Years before he met my young mother, he had served in the war. All our neighbors were my father's age, so I was always around old ones growing up, and that suited me just fine. There was Bill Delaney, who could fix anything needed fixing. Tommy Jackson, the town barber. One time, he had a hippie from Cornwall come in for a trim, but Tommy forced a proper haircut on him. There was Angus McGregor, and he was a fine fellow for the most part, but when he hit the jug too deep, his words would start to get obscene, and then profane. And then my father would lay a cross look on him, and Angus would lower his eyes and make his words clean. And, of course, there was always old Jack. They'd tell stories from the old days, from the war, from the Depression, and they'd tell jokes, too. My father would always tell the best jokes, and after the punchline, everybody would laugh to beat the band, including my father. And then, as the laughter was dying down, my father would repeat the punchline, and everybody would start laughing again. The best joke I remember my father telling was the one about the old fellow whose memory was failing him. "Did you ever hear tell of the old fellow who's having trouble remembering things? So he goes to the doctor, and the doctor prescribes him a medicine." "Well, don't believe I have, Lloyd," said Angus. "Well, his friend comes over one day and says, Jim, I understand you got some medicine for your memory. Now tell me, does it work? Oh, yes, says Jim. Works like a charm. Well, I'd like to get some of that medicine for myself. What's the name of it? Oh, the name of it, says Jim. Let me see. I can't remember. Now, what's the name? What's the name of that flower? Oh, I don't know, says Jim's friend. There's so many. Is it a tulip? No. No, it's that flower you take on a date with a woman. Oh, is it a carnation? No, no, it's the romantic one. It's red and long-stemmed. Oh, you must mean a rose. Yes, that's it, says Jim. Rose, what was the name of that medicine the doctor gave me for my memory? Well, everybody would laugh hard, and my father the hardest of all. And then, just as the laughter began to subside, he'd repeat, Rose, what's the name of that medicine? And everybody would laugh harder still. I would laugh, too, sitting cross-legged in the corner. I loved all my dad's jokes. But the real stories were better than the jokes, of course. They were the tales of when these old men were young men, living through the Depression, when there was nothing to be had. And if you couldn't find work, there was no government to bail you out, so you just went hungry. My dad became a railroad bum during those times. He owned nothing in the whole world but his own soul, and even that he knew could be taken from him. He kept busy avoiding people like Kitchener Leslie, an infamous Canadian National Railway cop, who was much scarier than the real police. If he found a bum on the property of CN Railway, sitting in an empty boxcar of a train, he would stomp and stomp with his steel-toed boots till the railroad bum was gone, and only the gray, still flesh of the bum remained in his place. Of course, the men told stories of when war came to Europe and turned scared boys from Moose Creek into heroes at Normandy. Old Jack, he could tell the best stories, because his were the most mysterious. It seems old Jack never had a home, that he somehow just sprang from the land itself, full-grown, and had been roving his whole life till he settled down with us. He'd been in the war, too, just like the rest of them, but he never told a single war story. His tales were about wandering the Canadian byways, filled with drink and song and loneliness and new places and friends. And they always held the other old men in thrall. And me, too. I had never made it past Moose Creek, and I knew I never would. Round about 10 o'clock, the men would be on their way, taking the happy loudness with them and leaving the farmhouse quieter than the crickets and the frogs outside. Then old Jack would say thank you to my dad, and see a sprite to me, before he trundled out and down the lane to the tool shed that was his home.